and welcome to Mint and Burn, the academic analysis of blockchain and other technologies in the decentralized digital economy. I'm your host, Kelsey Nabben, and we are tuning in remotely from the RMIT University Blockchain Innovation Hub to bring you expert guests and test frontier ideas. Today, we're speaking with Professor Elaine Marciano, alongside distinguished Professor Jason Potts and Professor Sinclair Davidson, on blockchains as clubs. Welcome to all of you.
Hello.
Thanks, Kelsey.
Hello.
Elaine, can you start us off by outlining for the audience what is a club?
Yes, sure. So basically, there are two, I would say there are two definitions, or the what is the standard definition of clubs. A club is usually viewed in economics as a good, or like swimming pools or roads, highways, more highways than roads. A good that for which there is a you have to pay a fee to have the possibility to use the good. And there is a possibility of excluding the individuals who didn't pay the fee to consume the good. So that's the standard view. A club, good. So the term club is usually associated with good. So usually we think of club goods and not really of clubs. What I want to stress, and what I wanted to stress on the different papers I wrote on clubs, is that Buchanan had a somewhat different view on clubs than that. For him, clubs were more infrastructures. There is a type of good plus a way of managing the good. A type of good plus some institutions. So we have to, I think that, so we have to see more clubs more as kind of institutional infrastructures, are ways of governing goods, of managing goods, than as goods per se.
That makes complete sense in the context of blockchains, I guess, as well. And Jason, perhaps you can add more color to this in terms of thinking of blockchains as institutional infrastructures and public goods.
Yeah, look, it's fantastic to have you here, Elaine. Sinclair, myself, and our colleagues, for the past few years, we've been making this argument that the work of James Buchanan and club theory, and a lot of these sort of early theorists of economic institutions, that did a lot of this work, sort of, you know, back in the late 50s and 60s, and you know, in a long time ago, right in the middle of the sort of growth period of the industrial economy, are newly relevant again in this world of digital economies, and in particular in terms of blockchain, because what seems to be happening to us is that the design, you talk about sort of club goods plus institutions, and what's fascinating at the moment is that these institutions have suddenly become things that people can build and program out of software. They can make these institutions themselves to form private infrastructure and other sort of ways of organizing people that that is different from, you know, instead of using firms or, you know, hierarchical organizations or using nation states and providing public goods, we've actually got what looks to us like this resurgence of club infrastructure, you know, local public goods or the sort of private provision of public infrastructure. And this is sort of an observation that we've made in terms of, you know, trying to understand the economic significance of blockchain, trying to understand the way in which digital economy, institutions in a digital economy seem to be actually different. And so, you know, we're absolutely thrilled to have you here to sort of discuss this point.
People don't really think of Buchanan when they think in the space. You know, we always kind of think of economic activity is driven either by governments doing things, you know, building infrastructure, or by corporations. And people haven't actually thought too much about clubs in this context, because we always think of clubs of, you know, you go to the local gym or you have some sort of local infrastructure and this sort of stuff. Whereas clubs are actually a mechanism for coordinating human behavior. And we've known this for a long time, and we've been doing this for a long time, but we we kind of have these artificial barriers in our minds as to sort of, you know, what is the economy, what is leisure, what is this, and what, you know, whereas in actual fact, there is a continuum of cooperation, and clubs fit well into that continuum. And I mean, I don't know how true this is, but my kind of feeling is that club theory over the last while had almost been, you know, sort of relegated to the second league. People weren't thinking too much about club theory. Certainly when I was reading Buchanan, I used to focus a lot more on his tax stuff and on his Leviathan stuff. And a club theory was always one of these things. Oh, yeah, he's kind of interested in it, but it didn't sort of strike me as being that important. And yet here we are. I think club describes precisely what happens in the blockchain space because people come and go. You got to pay a fee. You can't really exclude, but you can. You know, so I'm like really excited that to sort of, dare I say, neglected part of Buchanan's theory is actually so important.
Elaine, could you perhaps explain for us a little bit more about what Buchanan's theory and your work that builds on that provides in terms of insights around the economics of club goods for those that are less familiar, such as myself?
Yes, and I think that what I'm going to say is directly related from what Jason and Sinclair just said, in the sense that for first, one of the reasons for which Buchanan's club theory has been more or less relegated to second league is that it's frequently associated with Tchibou. And then Tchibou's work is supposed to have predated Buchanan's work. Therefore, we more frequently view Buchanan's theory on clubs as a kind of more recent version of Tchibou's version on clubs, which is not the case again, because it's for Buchanan, it's more than clubs are more than goods. And another problem is also that this is what you said about the local goods. Usually clubs are viewed as local goods. Therefore, it cannot be used for blockchains because people are not in a close to each other when they use blockchain. So there are people spread all around the world, and therefore the local dimension disappears. So I think that if we remove this idea that club goods are local goods, then it makes sense to apply it to blockchains and to networks that bring together people that who are spread on the entire planet. And another point which I think is important that relates to what you said is that you mentioned the fact that people can use software to build private infrastructures. And it's important to remind that Buchanan, not only Buchanan, but I mentioned Buchanan because I'm more or less specialized on this work, but that was also the case of, to a certain extent, Coase and maybe Tulloch too, but many other people from what is called the Virginia School of Political Economy. And Buchanan made the distinction between three types of three ways of organizing human interactions. The market, so everything that goes on the market, so the private interactions, we can do things alone. We don't need others. And if we need others, we can cooperate through a price mechanism. So this is true for private goods. And there is the government intervention. And usually economists probably, so my, I don't want to blame too much on him, but my claim and one of the claims that I've made with Pete Buttke, for instance, in works together, is that this comes from people like Samuelson. People from like Samuelson and also Musgrave, but they were not the only ones. A lot of economists believe that there are markets and the government, and there is a straight line between the two, clear separation between the two, and the separation between the two is obvious. When markets fail, then the government has to step in and solve the market failures. And Coase arrived and Buchanan arrived in the Virginia School of Political Economy, the Virginia political economists arrived and said, no, we have the market, we have the government intervention, and there is a third way of organizing human interactions, the private contracts. So we collective action is not only, does not only mean government intervention. So you can have collective action that is not a private, purely private, because it's collective, but that does not involve the government. And this relates to clubs. Clubs are a form of these collective arrangements that people build to organize their interactions. And I think that if I understood the concept correctly, from what I read from your work in particular, is that blockchains are this kind of stuff. This is what I like with digital technology, is that digital technology allows individuals to devise and to build and to organize, to manage private collective actions that are not purely private, purely individual, but that do not require the intervention of the government.
Yes, and certainly it doesn't necessitate a political governance as opposed to a private governance or a corporate governance. And I think one of the challenges that we have in the space is that when blockchain emerged, there were a lot of people who knew Hayek, because they knew Hayek's theories of money and they knew Hayek's socialist calculation debate story. And so a lot of the people emerging in the space only knew Hayek. And so when we burst onto the scene in 2015, 2016, talking about these crazy ideas of other economists, you know, Coase, Williamson, Buchanan, nobody had ever heard of them. And I have to say, I still think that there hasn't been enough penetration of these people's ideas into the blockchain space, because we still have people talking very naive economic models where there is a political governance solution and all other solutions are bad because economists assume spherical cows and zero transaction costs and make all those sorts of assumptions, which I have to say, maybe first year economic students do, but serious economists do not. And so, Alain, it was really exciting to see your body of work, thinking, wow, people really need to see this stuff and read this stuff to actually have an understanding of some proper serious economics that would lead directly into making blockchains more useful and more valuable and more understandable. So very exciting. So
just on that point, can I ask you, Alain, just to speculate on what you think the main lessons are from Buchanan and club theory for a digital economy, you talked about how people sort of misunderstand Thiebaud and sort of foot voting and sort of think of it as a physical geographical argument as opposed to a network argument. Mm. What are the main lessons of Buchanan's framework for thinking about digital economies? I mean, the obvious one to me just seems to be around externalities, around some non-rivalrous goods and the idea that we're dealing with.
Well, again, so I think that there are many lessons. The points I already mentioned, I repeat them because I think that they are important. They are the starting points. The clubs are ways of organizing human interactions and not only goods. And the possibility to devise collective action privately without necessarily having the government to make any rule or to organize these collective actions. But also this thing which is important is that if you have a club or if you organize collective action privately, you need a kind of social contract. At least you need rules. You need rules to organize clubs. So it's not pure spontaneous order. This is something that the people who start from Hayek and referring to Hayek when they organize club, when they think about blockchains. One of the confusions, I'm not sure because I'm not familiar with the literature, but one of the things that can be confusing if you refer to Hayek in the case of blockchains is that you may think that it's purely spontaneous and there is no need for a social contract or a kind of organization. So what I think we can add to Hayekian, but I'm more not only familiar, but more convinced that by Buchanan than by Hayek, even if the two are not opposed. But I think that in addition to the kind of private organization, you need rules to organize. You need a constitution to organize the functioning of a club. Or even if it's not a very detailed constitution, as we have in France or in Europe, it can be just a set of rules that define what you have to do, what you don't have to do. This is one of the things. Another point which is important is that you are talking about externalities. So it's a different story. So that were the lessons I would emphasize. And to the point I mentioned earlier, I added the fact that you need rules to organize these interactions. But if you start thinking about externalities. So Buchanan made one point, which is that all externalities don't have to be internalized. So I think that we can also, so he said that there are some externalities that are Pareto irrelevant, in the sense that it's irrelevant from to internalize these externalities because it's not going to improve the situation from a Parisian perspective. So this is interesting in the sense that means that we can tolerate a little bit of external effects in the positive or negative external effects in the club or outside the club or in the economy. And but it's not necessarily going to deteriorate the economic situation or the functioning of the group. I think that we probably have to make the distinction between negative and positive externalities. But I think that positive externalities is something that we can anticipate. So we should tolerate maybe it's different from Buchanan here, but we should tolerate some positive externalities, because positive externalities are also means are going to generate effects that are not anticipated. And if we force people to internalize the externalities, then we are going to reduce the positive effects that we can anticipate from these external effects. So I don't know if I was clear, but it's also an interesting and important idea to study. And if I may add something about cause, you mentioned cause and transaction cost and zero transaction costs and all that. Of course, cause was very important. And when he wrote what he wrote about the problem of social cost, he was the Virginia, so he was close to Buchanan, etc. But one of the points that Buchanan made, so Buchanan did not really refer to transaction cost. Yeah. It's not that transaction costs are confusing. They are very important to take them into account is very important. But the way Stigler and the Chicagoans tended to emphasize, and the critics, of course, tended to emphasize transaction cost, I think that it obscured the result that Coase wanted to put forward, which is that we can cooperate. And we can build agreements, private agreements. And I will stop there. And Buchanan did not really refer to transaction cost, which may be an advantage because people did not focus too much on this obstacle, looking more on the advantages of organizing the interactions.
Yes, I think probably even more neglected than club theory is Buchanan's view and Stubblebean's view on externalities. In a past life when I used to teach honors level microeconomics, I actually used to make the students read that particular paper. And they had never before encountered the idea of a Pareto irrelevant externality. It just never occurred to anybody that once you imagine an externality, obviously the government must immediately jump in. Whereas in actual fact, in equilibrium, that externality may no longer exist. It may not matter for resource allocation purposes. And actually explaining that to students is quite difficult because they've never before encountered that. And even some sort of professional economists, they've never before encountered that. And more importantly, so for blockchain purposes, very often what has been generated is a positive externality. And of course, if you've come from the traditional view, positive externalities would never occur because nobody would ever do it. And yet we have people doing it all the time. The whole open source software environment is all about creating positive externalities. And then you build in communities and tokens in order to capture those positive externalities or network effects or flywheel effects, whatever you want to call them. So from a traditional economics perspective, if you are looking at blockchain, depending upon how hardline you want to be, you might even say this couldn't possibly exist, which, of course, as Co said, when an economist sees something they don't understand, it's immediately a monopoly or it's immediately something terrible and bad. And that, to my mind, very often explains a lot of the mainstream economic hostility that we see to blockchain, because in a traditional neoclassical type environment, it couldn't possibly exist. So therefore, these people are obviously crooks and scammers and doing the wrong sort of thing. Again, which is why Buchanan and Stubblebean on externalities should be on everybody's radar. Bearing in mind, of course, I find reading Buchanan very hard going. You actually have to set aside a good period of time because His writing is like the last Mad Max movie. It starts and it goes, you know. So reading Buchanan is like being at the fire hydrant of knowledge and ideas just bursting down upon you. But definitely his views on club theory are so important. His views on externalities, again, so important. But Elena, I want to engage you a bit because you mentioned Stigler and Coase. And I'm a huge, huge fan of Stigler, certainly a younger version of myself. Just love Stigler. I learned so much from reading Stigler. But I have to say, in more recent years, I haven't reread Stigler, whereas you can always reread Coase. Now, you've written a paper where you kind of say, well, Stigler came up with the Coase theorem, which wasn't the Coase theorem, and I think you're very kind to Stigler because you actually explained why he did what he did. But perhaps you could tell the audience, what Coase was up to, and then what Stigler was up to, to just sort of like explain that, tease that out a bit.
I don't know. I was going to say I agree with you. I don't know if I agree with the young you or the. Or the Swan, because I think that Stigler is really a very important economist, one of the most important economists of the 20th century, which is not breaking new. I mean, everyone should know that. And I think where I disagree with you is when about rereading Stigler. I think that reading Stigler is still very interesting, especially the papers he wrote in history on the history of economics and the methodology of economics in the 1950s, when he had all these exchange with Friedman about the methodology of economics. It's very interesting. And so this is the connection with what he viewed in Coase. Well, so for causes analysis was a means, I think, for Stigler to establish a result that he wanted to have established, which is that markets work. And this is, again, a difference with Buchanan in the sense that for Buchanan, markets can fail. So Buchanan, and we have, again, a connection with what I said earlier about collective action. For Buchanan, markets can fail. He never said that markets could not fail. So market failure exists, but market failures are not a problem. Because by contrast with what most economists say, market failures are not a problem because and as long individuals can find the solutions to solve them, to deal with them. And he was convinced that that's also the point about externalities. He was convinced that if there is a problem, then there is a solution. If there is a problem, then individuals will find a solution. And if what reveals that there was a problem is that individuals have found a solution. So I think this is also interesting. So I'm deviating, I'm not answering your question, but I will. So I think this is also important for blockchains in the sense that if individuals develop blockchains or develop agreements through the softwares or the digital means, it is because they had a problem to solve and they find a solution to the problem. So the existence of these mechanisms reveals that there was a problem and that the individuals had found a way to solve this problem. And I think this is a connection with also the concept of externalities. Because for Buchanan, an externality is something you cannot decide ex ante that there is going to be an externality. So for most economists, externalities and public goods exist objectively. When the utility functions or production functions are interdependent. For Buchanan, this does not mean that the externality, this means that there is an externality, but this does not mean that the externality has to be dealt with. You have to solve the problem that the externality represents only if the individuals want to solve the problem. So again, we are changing the perspective. Instead of saying that we have an externality, it's objective, it's a fact, we cannot ignore it, therefore the government should step in. Buchanan said, yes, there is the externality, but if the individuals don't want to solve this externality, then you don't have to do anything about it. And to a certain extent, it's not a relevant externality. It's an externality, but it's not relevant. To go back to Coase, to Coase and Stigler, I think, well, Stigler wanted to demonstrate that the market works and markets work and that they don't fail, and that Coase's demonstration was a demonstration of that. If markets are competitive, purely competitive, if there is competition, then the outcome of this competitive market is going to be efficient, even if there are externalities and interdependencies between the economic agents. So it's an idea that crosses my mind now, but I'm just wondering if we couldn't say that there is something of Buchanan in that too, in the sense that if you say that markets work and externalities are solved by markets, it means that the markets, the externalities are not genuine problems, just like for Buchanan. So I didn't really answer your question, but partly.
I really like that way of framing it. So I think this notion that in the sort of standard approach to economics, externalities are a negative thing. You're dealing with market failures and this idea that the identification of negative externalities implies government step in. But your point was that the focus and Buchanan's focus is actually around positive externalities in cooperation, that if a group of people, and this is because this is what we see in the blockchain space all the time, is that the thing about the crypto economy and open source software and just a lot of digital economy production is that, first of all, a group of people come together form a community and figure out ways to impose positive externalities on each other, right? That's which is the classic definition of a club, is a group of people come together to impose positive externalities on each other. And what the sort of blockchain concept of blockchain as institutions or as rules to facilitate that cooperation is that you can then throw up some economic infrastructure around that, around those cooperatively, imaginatively identified positive externalities that were discovered. And I think this is what we just keep seeing over and over again, is this notion that's what we're observing here as this process of, as this technology is moving into the economy. What it's throwing up is not, you know, productivity improvements in industry. What it's throwing up is all of this emergent cooperative institutional technology that is entirely focused on positive externalities and the identification, discovery, and capture of them. It just occurred to me that the name we give to this tokenomics, or this process of token design, is just literally that, right? If Buchanan were around today, he would immediately recognize that and go, "Ah, yeah, you mean that's what I was working on." And I think this has sort of been a slow discovery for us, is that connection between tokenomics, which actually grew out of mechanism design and game theory and a whole bunch of, you know, what looked like optimization calculus applied to, you know, things, is actually far closer in its intellectual spirit to this positive externality definition of the discovery of institutions to capture positive externality, i.e. a club. I really like that way of framing it. With that in mind, the other thing we wanted to, I mean, so I think to me that's been really useful in actually framing, you know, why Buchanan is relevant and why Buchanan's technical concept of externalities is relevant to this story. But the other thing we wanted to talk about was law and economics, the UCLA tradition, Elkian, Demsetz, those guys. And this is another group of economists that, you know, there's a certain sort of economist that lives and breathes that and just knows that tradition well. And then there's a much larger set of economists that has never heard of this. And it doesn't appear in any first year textbooks. You can pass through an entire degree in economics without ever coming across or grasping the law and economics tradition. Now, you've done a lot of work to sort of try and, you know, some scholarship around what was going on back then in 1950s, 1960s, UCLA. Could you provide us with just a brief, I mean, it's just an overview of, you know, what was going on there? Why were they thinking about this? And what are the sort of main lessons from that intersection of institutions, law, and economics?
I'm not that familiar with this period, less familiar with what was happening in Virginia and with Buchanan. But so the point is that at the same time, more or less at the same time, there were some people like, of course, Elkian, and then a bit later, the Demsetz, who started to recognize indeed that the property rights matter. So I didn't really work on the connection between the two, but again, to stay focused on the main thing, I think that the clubs and property rights are more or less belong to the same kind of stream of thought, in the sense that property rights are a means that allow individuals to guarantee the organization, or to guarantee themselves the benefits of an activity. So there were these people in UCLA who started to recognize too, as in Virginia, that economics shouldn't be only a matter of, let's say, economics. Economics shouldn't be only a matter of optimization and of maximization of social welfare functions, but economics is about institutions. And if you want to understand economic problems, you have to understand. So it's another form of the same claim. If you want to understand economic problems, you have to understand the institutional nature of economic problems, and therefore you have to understand what are the what is the most basic institution that you need to organize human activity in a world in which there is scarcity, which are property rights. But what is interesting is that property rights are also can be viewed as a means to organize scarcity and to a certain extent to to ignore scarcity, in the sense that if you have property rights, just like if you have clubs, if you have property rights, scarcity becomes something that is managed collectively. So we shift away from Samuelson's idea and from the ideas of most economists that economic goods are scarce, and this is an objective property of goods. Yes, of course, it's an objective property of goods, but instead of focusing on the objectivity of this fact that goods are scarce, we should focus on the institutions that we need to build institutions, property rights, to organize the management of scarcity. And again, you see, it's not really about, I'm not really talking about the historical dimension of UCLA, Alkian, and Demsetz, but I think here that the important point I want to emphasize is this one. We have different types of scholars. They knew each other, of course, but they were at different places in different locations, and they had a similar idea. There are objective problems, of course, but these objective problems should not be treated as objective problems. They should be treated as subjective problems in terms of the organization, the institutions that individuals devise to manage these problems. So scarcity is indeed a problem, but if you have institutional solutions to deal with scarcity, it's no longer a problem. Well, it's a problem that you have found a solution to.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's actually the important point, is that in mainstream economics, it's all about optimization. So we've got a constraint. We've only got so much of this and so much of that, and how do we apportion it? Whereas I think in the Virginia schools and the Chicago school and the UCLA school, in that tradition, it's always about human ingenuity. How do we actually approach problems? How do we cooperate under the division of labor, which is the way in which Mises described a market? And sometimes we cooperate by having government at a broad macro level, and then that's what Hayek spoke about very often, sort of the trade-off between the government and the market. Sometimes we have between hierarchies and the market, and that's where Coase and Williamson were, and then the different rights that we have in these markets. That's what Alkin and Demsetz kind of were, and again in the mainstream we have this crazy idea that property rights come from the government. And even in his earlier papers, Alkin was saying, well, that's what it sounds like. But when you actually dig deep into it, it's actually people coordinating their activities. And before, when Alain was talking about the rules, you know, a lot of people kind of think, well, if you have rules, you don't have competition. Well, that's not true. I mean, imagine we were setting up a poker game. We would have, you know, are we playing regular poker? Are we playing Texas Hold'em? You know, so very often we cooperate before we compete, and it's those cooperation aspects that I kind of think are really important, that you really need to dig deep into to actually understand how economies work. And when you come to blockchain, it's all about people actually cooperating to do a thing. And that is why, more or less, I kind of think if you need to think beyond Hayek. You need to go to Coase. You need to go to Buchanan. You need to go to Williamson. You need to go to Alkin. You need to go to Demsetz. You know, you need to break out of the Samuelson approach to doing economics, because you will very quickly become frustrated and be at a dead end, I kind of feel.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and it's sort of starting to make sense for me from a non-economist perspective as well. Elaine, you mentioned something earlier about you do need rules to organize clubs, and it's not just spontaneous order. And from reflection on the history of the blockchain space, I guess Hayek was someone that sort of some of the original cypherpunks on the cypherpunk mailing list were really sort of obsessed with his ideas. But we have actually seen that evolve in the blockchain space in terms of lots of DAOs, so these kind of commons type communities, are actually writing themselves what they're calling constitutions as a kind of social contract or set of rules, and describing themselves as commons, and are strongly linking to a lot of Ostrom's ideas. So I'm really interested for you to speak more about the kind of rules of these social games as people coordinate.
I'm not so sure about the kind of rules, but what I can say is that competition needs rules. So it makes a bridge between your question and what Sinclair earlier said, that competition is not opposed to rules, and rules are not opposed to competition. So most of the time, maybe it's, so I'm not going to say that about Hayek, because, but maybe it's the reason why some of the critics about blockchains and about this kind of spontaneous order had in mind when they criticized or still criticize blockchains, the idea that blockchain is a kind of world without rules, kind of anarchy, people buying and selling things in total illegality, and which shouldn't be the case. It cannot be the case, because if it were the case, it wouldn't work. I mean, competition cannot work. And again, this is something that Buchanan insisted on. And it, I think it's neglected when people read, talk about Buchanan and talk about his work and criticize his work, that they have this idea that Buchanan was a pro-market, radical pro-market economist, kind of libertarian who was interested only in competition, pure competition, which is not the case. And for I think that for blockchains, the lesson is also the same. We need, of course, we don't want to plan the organization, but we need to... Buchanan had this expression, not planning against competition, but planning for competition. So we need to plan, we need to organize, we need rules for the social game. Therefore, we need rules for blockchains as well. So the question is that for, so this is where maybe I am going to ask you a question, but because this is where in the, I would say non-digital, I was going to say the real world, but in the non-digital world, yes, it's a bit, it's a naive way of saying the things, but in the non-digital world, we can sit around the table, or we can talk to each other and then devise rules, these rules of the social game, without which the game is not going to work. In the digital economy, I'm not sure how it can be made, but even if blockchains have to work, if they can work, if they can function, I don't see how they could work without having a kind of regulation. The regulation can be more or less spontaneous. So the rules can emerge from the... This is where there's a divergence between Buchanan and Hayek. So Buchanan did not agree with Hayek about that. Rules for Hayek, rules could emerge, and the rules that had emerged from a spontaneous process were legitimate because they had emerged from the process. So for Buchanan, it was different because the rules could not really emerge, so they had to emerge at least within a constitutional frame that had to be devised and defined in the first place. So I don't know how it can be made in the digital world, in the digital economy, but I think it's necessary too.
Yeah, and this is what we're seeing right now, I think, is this, as Kelsey was saying, some of the projects out there are working on constitutions and trying to design the fundamental, just, you know, layer one rules to govern everything that will be built upon it, when they don't quite know what they're going to build upon it yet. It's just these are the foundational rules. But we're also seeing, I mean, what I think is interesting about this is this notion of institutional design, or this notion of experimental on-the-fly institutional design, where these communities, these clubs are coming together and trying to work out the rules for competition and trade amongst the new property rights. So a lot of the token, you know, what is a token? A token really is just property rights that are being built to attach to an object that is then computationally legible. So you've got this sort of private property rights systems being built that then you have rules attached to what they can do, who can own them, what the transfer conditions are, what does it disappear under, what circumstances. This real sort of computable, but what I find fascinating about this is it's kind of in the metaverse, it's in the digital universe, but it's also living, you know, in a regulatory environment that is, you know, to various degrees specified or tacit or unclear or missing. So you've got this sort of nested relationship of these new types of constitutions and institutions that are being designed and written.
To drive cooperation. And what we've had throughout human history is plenty of experimentation as to how people can work together to make things happen. And sometimes it succeeded and sometimes it hasn't succeeded. But what has been one of the major impediments all along is actually credibly communicating local knowledge and credibly communicating tacit knowledge. Now, generally speaking, that's what markets are supposed to do. They're supposed to tease out local knowledge. They're supposed to tease out tacit knowledge. But because we've had these credibility problems in communicating this, a lot of these previous attempts at human cooperation have failed. And so now we have this technology where you can, in a trustless manner, communicate this information. And so a lot of the experiments which we've seen before, which have previously failed, might this time succeed. So it's actually, you know, from an institutional evolution approach, this is actually an exciting time to be watching all of these things happen. And I'm kind of thinking if Harold Emsetz were alive, he would very clearly recognize how new property rights are emerging, how existing property rights are recombining, in terms of his 1967 paper towards the theory of property rights. So I imagine if he were alive today, he would be very excited in seeing this, because it's not the spontaneous order that Hayek imagined, where all of a sudden things would just happen. It's actually a reemergence and recombination of property rights, which is ongoing, which is actually driving a lot of this new forms of cooperation. So that's very interesting to actually see, you know, economic theories where Demsitz was talking about beavers and in Labrador and all this other stuff 200 years ago. you're actually seeing this really happening in front of your eyes today.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Sinclair, because we've been trying to figure out how to approach this. So, I mean, are we scholars and scientists studying just some live experiments that are institutional experiments that are happening in real time? And we just sit back and try and just marvel at the you know, the richness of the experiments, of the natural experiments. But at the same time, and we've got genuine just governance problems that require institutional engineering solutions, and people are building these things and looking for help and advice and, you know, analytic frameworks to try and do this. And I think what the question I also want to ask you is just, you know, based upon your you know, experience in this space, are we heading towards institutional economists as becoming more like engineers and designers in this space, or is that a dangerous path? I mean, or should we just really stick to disinterested scholars standing back, just trying to study this and you know, measure and study and write papers about this. It really seems like there's two options. I mean, that we could possibly do both of these.
Well, I think that I have always had difficulties with this engineer view of economics and institutions. So this is why I'm a bit reluctant when I see people saying that, well, we think that we can manage everything, so we can organize, or the world is a machine, so we know where to put our money, our coin, and then we will have 10 coins at the end of the... So I'm not sure it works like that. Yeah, so I think that's so one of the features of these economists we talked about is humility. And we don't know much about what is going to happen. That's economic life and social life is complex. So there are a lot of things that I'm not going to cite and quote Bastiat, but it's the same thing. There are a lot of things that happen. We don't see them. We don't know about them. So it's very difficult to plan. So this is why also rules for the game are important. If we have a framework, well, a constitution, as you said. So, and this is what I find fascinating with blockchains, even if I'm not, I didn't take time to pay too much attention to that. But I think what is interesting is precisely the desire to build these constitutions, to organize something that looks like totally not organized, totally spontaneous, anarchical. And I think that this is one of the, for me, this is one of the most, interesting and fascinating lesson that I get from our talk and from reading about blockchains. This interest that the people working on blockchains have for constitutions and rules of the game. And I will stop there to say that it's interesting that blockchains, this new technology, this kind of revolutionary technology, is reviving economies that were heterodox and marginal and that are still viewed as marginal. So it's going to be something very dominant in our... So we are in an economy that is based on digital stuff, that is based on blockchains, digital economy. And we are obliged to look to economies we were seen as marginal, as secondary. So it's important now to look back to the history of the 20th century of economics and to say that, well, maybe the most important economists were not the ones we think who were. So it's a bit radical and a bit extreme to conclude, but...
But it is a nice point to conclude on. So thank you so much to our guest, Professor Elaine Marciano, alongside distinguished Professor Jason Potts and Professor Sinclair Davidson. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Mint and Burn. You can check out the show notes and get in touch if you have ideas or feedback at rmitblockchain.io.